each one, which brings into line some new language from the ABA, which I would urge you not to consider because, although it tries to get at the idea of prejudicial joinder, the difficulty is no court has ever told us what these words mean. There is no track record. Presently, we have a clear understanding of joinder under Oregon law. And if we're going to go into a new uncharted area, I would simply urge the committee to do nothing on this bill, because the problems I have with the LC-1 amendments are that they are uncharted. We don't know what the words mean. We'll have to go through a lot of litigation at the trial court level and at the appellate level, which I think is going to be unproductive for all sides. And if that was the choice, I would urge you to take no action. The amendment that I have proposed to you as an ODAA proposed amendment to this bill is precisely the same as the LC draft until you get to line 22. And you can see where the typing becomes darker. That is the change, and it basically stays the same except for section 3, which again is the severance capabilities. And subsection 3 in the ODAA proposed amendment is Federal Rule 14 for severance. And it simply says that when the state or the defendant is prejudiced by a joinder of offenses, then the court may order an election or separate trials or provide whatever other relief justice requires. I would ask the committee, in adopting that amendment, to also adopt Ninth Circuit, or to take as legislative history the Ninth Circuit interpretations of what is prejudice. And so that is the third handout that I have given you, is a memorandum which talks about joinder, the federal rules, and then lists the exceptions for severance under the Ninth Circuit cases and the reasons given for the courts for allowing severance. And basically it comes down to prejudice to a defendant, whether or not he would have inconsistent defenses at trial and want to have a defense to one charge that's inconsistent with a defense to another charge. In that situation, he'd be allowed to sever those cases. The reason I would ask that is that there is a track record with the federal court interpretations. We'd be tying into language that we do know what it means and that would cut down tremendously on the litigation at the trial court level and on the appellate level, and we'd have a given that we could work with. Rather than the LC amendment, which has never been tested and is not adopted, to my understanding. Appreciate the time to present that to you. I know this is a lot of information all at one time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let me give the committee a little bit of background maybe the committee members aren't aware of, but if you'll take a look at the original bill, you'll see it's a one-sentence bill, and it would, in effect, allow, without any discretion, the joinder of offenses, if they were of the same character, same or similar character, so, and I think that this is admitted by the district attorneys that they could take five burglaries committed 7 months apart and join them in one indictment and have one trial, and without regard to the potential prejudice, and so that was rather unacceptable. Then, at least that was my reaction to it. Anyway, so I had Mark Kramer start doing some work on this. He spent a lot of time on this and said it was the bill in its original form did present a lot of problems. It would require a lot of amending in order to come to a place that it would be both workable and fair, and so I told him to get together with the district attorneys, which he did late last week, and he talked with Dale, and he talked with some people from the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office, and as I understand it now, each was going to come back in with some amendments. So this is the district attorney's suggested approach. And I don't have the benefit of counsel's having been able to analyze these amendments. I don't think, Eric, have you, you yourself haven't gotten into this thing. But that's kind of the background. And And that's what we're here today, I suppose. We're going to hear from a representative of the defense bar in a minute. And Now, in the last session, we passed some legislation that permitted joinder of defendants in certain cases, didn't we?
Two sessions ago, there was a bill that was passed, and that has not changed practice at all. Ballot Measure 10, which was the Victims' Rights Initiative, basically adopted the joinder of defendants and adopted the federal rule for joinder of defendants. And so if you had one victim, two defendants committed a crime upon that victim, you could join them together. This Our amendment would then adopt Federal Rule 8 for joinder of offenses and then the Federal Rule for severance of joinder of defendants or joinder of offenses.
Well, anyway, it's a pretty technical area of the law, and I kind of wanted to let the committee members know that it hasn't been easy to get to this point. Okay, do you have any questions, Mr. Penn? Yes,
yeah.
Senator Brenneman.
Mr. Penn, you said that the Dash 1 amendments as amended you didn't care for, that you wanted this memorandum added to it, or the principles of the memorandum added.
Yes. It's actually different language. I've entitled mine, and I apologize, the Xerox didn't go very well there, but ODAA proposed amendments. It's different language, which is our amendments as Rule 8 and Rule 14, joinder offenses and severance. This LC Draft 1 amendment is the same until you get to line 26, and then from that point forward is the ABA standard for severance, which to my knowledge has not been adopted by any state and has not been tested by any court. And it is a different procedure and it uses different terms. And the problem with that is that we don't know what those terms would be, and it would require trial courts to interpret that themselves and then the appellate courts in Oregon to decide what that means, and we really wouldn't know what it is until a few years from now. And because of that, if it came down to the committee taking no action or adopting LC1, I would urge you to take no action, because I really don't know where this would lead us, and I think it would cost us a lot of money to find out.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I think that Senator Brenneman's question went to the issue of this memorandum from Eric Lindell to you.
Oh, okay.
And the question was whether some of that was supposed to be interpreted in, added as statutory language, or whether you simply wanted this in the record for interpretation purposes.
I wanted it in the record and to acknowledge that those are the Ninth Circuit opinions of Federal Rule 14, which tells us what is prejudice, which allows severance. And that would be legislative history, and that the committee would be adopting the Ninth Circuit interpretation of the word prejudice, so the courts would have guidance and we would have direction, and what does that word mean? And that was my intent for that.
I guess by way of further background, I asked committee counsel to work with legislative counsel to take care of some of the concerns that had come up, and the Dash 1 amendment is the product of the conversation, I guess, with Mr. Penn and with the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. And each one of them really is coming in here with some suggested changes to the Dash 1. Yes, Senator Hamby.
Mr. Penn, is there any desire, if we are unable to incorporate your proposed or ODAA's proposed amendments to this bill, do you desire in the least the House Bill 2193 as it came to the House, from the House to this committee? Would it be of any help?
Oh, yes, certainly.
I love that.
I just wanted that to make sure.
Yes.
That's the number one form, I think it's fair to say, isn't it? Okay, well, we might have you come back in a minute, Dale. And in the meantime, Diana Stewart, please.
If I could hand these up to
you. While she's getting ready to testify, I want to say to the committee members, this is really This is a real change in Oregon criminal procedure, so that's why it has not been considered lightly by anyone. It's been a real struggle to get to this point, as I've said. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Diana Stewart. I'm an attorney with the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. I'm the senior felony attorney in that office. We come down urging the committee to reject either of the proposed bills before this committee at this time. I misspoke myself to Senator Frey and have not had an opportunity to see the ODAA amendments. I was handed the amended version that's 2193-1, so I've not had an opportunity, but I think I have some idea of what's being proposed in it. Thank you.
It's really the section.
Okay. First of all, to start at the end of a comment made by Senator Hamby, we urge this committee to not consider House Bill 2193 as it came over to the committee. Our concern with the entire way that this matter has been held proposed to the legislature is that the bill proposed to the House was a misleading bill. It did not give the House full information, and as it currently stands, we believe that it's unconstitutional. At the time that it was presented to the House, there was no acknowledgement made to the House that there was not a severance procedure in Oregon law. So if this bill were adopted as proposed, there would, in Oregon, be mandatory joinder of offenses, as Senator Frey mentioned, from an entire period of a statute of limitations with absolutely no severance procedure. And there is no jurisdiction in the country, federal or state, that does not have a severance procedure. We believe it would be a violation of due process to force a person into a trial setting with evidence coming in to that trial which would not have been permitted under the rules of evidence otherwise had it not been for joinder. So we urge you not to consider 2193 as it stands, that certainly severance is necessary should some action be taken. Our minimum standard as far as what we think would be acceptable in the state is the ABA standards, which, as I understand, was what was attempted to be drafted into 2193. Our main concern at this point is that it's late in the game, late in the session, to be tinkering with Oregon law on such substantial and controversial issues. There are committees throughout the United States just studying the issue of joinder and severance. In fact, the American Bar Association and the Uniform Trial Court Rules, had a number of conferences of commissioners who studied the issue throughout the United States and came up with proposed standards. The Uniform Rules of Criminal Procedure are actually more liberal standards as far as joinder, severance, and say that where there are situations where joinder has occurred, the offense shall be severed on the motion of a party, either defense or state, unless the court determines that because of a significant risk that material evidence would not otherwise be preserved, would be lost, the severance would defeat the ends of justice. So it's a very strict standard, and it has severance almost as of right. We're concerned that the committee not consider without further investigation the chart that was presented to the committee on what the current state of the law is throughout the United States. We only had an opportunity to specifically get into the statutes of the first five or six states, but in Alabama, for example, it was incorrectly cited. We could find no liberal joinder statute at all that was cited in that chart. In Alaska, they were correct on the liberal joinder, but there was also a severance of right where fairness dictated. In Arizona, correct on joinder, but allowed severance as a matter of right when joined with a similar character kind of offense, the one that's causing most of the concern today. We are equally concerned that the committee and the legislature has not been presented with any substantial reason for this change in Oregon law. Oregon has a well-litigated, well-understood joinder procedure currently in effect. We have seen nothing other than the statement that it would be cost-effective to indicate that there's a real need here, a need for us to be embarking on uncharted territory. We are concerned also, I personally disagree with Mr. Penn's characterization that if the Ninth Circuit interpretation was adopted that Oregon would not be looking at lots of litigation. The Ninth Circuit follows the federal rule, which says that if joinder in these various categories is permitted, that it's discretionary with the court to determine a number of items. There's litigation all over the United States throughout the 11 circuits about what is abuse of discretion and was it discretionary here, wasn't it discretionary here, was there an issue of fairness, was it you know, all kinds of issues that are currently being litigated. There's not litigation occurring over the Oregon standards as they currently stand. I see no situation occurring frequently in the courthouse where people have multiple charges and they're not, and a negotiation is occurring or there's some reason for everything to be showing up in the same courtroom where people aren't able to pull all the cases together and present them in one hearing. To say that it's cost effective, I think, circumvents the real issue, which is an attempt to have multiple offenses in the same courtroom at the same time, which would permit evidence to be before a jury or a judge, which would not otherwise be admissible if just the regular rules of evidence were in effect. We are urging you to not adopt ODAA's amendments, which are based on the federal amendments which are being litigated throughout the United States, and as a minimum, should the committee adopt anything, to follow the ABA standards. Again, I haven't had an opportunity to look at this very carefully and compare it with the ABA standards 2193-1. But we would hope that at this time the committee would say, if there's a need, ODAA, come back next session, document the need, present it to us, start out with us all understanding up front what the issues are, give us all an opportunity to study what the issues are, and then let's deal with it on the merits instead of dealing with things at the last moment when people haven't had an adequate opportunity to study the effects. Thank you.
Questions? Where's Dale gone? Dale. To your knowledge, has this issue ever been the subject of an interim study? Or is this the first time the bill's been introduced, to your knowledge?
Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned before, two sessions ago there was some change in the statute. I think at that time we had proposed the federal rules, and it got amended to the point that the statute really didn't change procedure at all. I don't know of an interim study, so I can't answer that question.
Well,
I might say only that this was a pre-session filed bill. There was full hearings in the House. We stated in the House that we'd be prepared to accept severance kinds of amendments. The House chose fit not to put those amendments on. No one's tried to hide the ball from anyone here. We do believe that there is a real cost saving to indigent defense to have multiple cases tried in one trial. And I can cite anecdotal situations where it's been very expensive and very difficult to try multiple cases. And we think with the safeguards there that we proposed that there will be no prejudice, that it's unfair.
Well, I'm sure you feel that way, and of course, I think as a prosecutor with 8 years of experience in prosecuting a lot of felony cases, I sensed when I first saw this bill that this is a dramatic change in Oregon criminal law, and I was a little bit uncomfortable from the beginning. I suppose that's one reason that the bill didn't get a very high priority in my mind, because that's kind of the response that I had, and I suppose I should have followed my instincts, but here I am on the last day, so to speak, and I've laid this problem on my committee members' heads, and I don't know about the other members, but I just have an awful hard time trying to sort out all the pieces on something that's so terribly significant. However, anyone else have a feeling on which way we should go on this?
Mr. Chairman, the idea behind it I like, particularly in the fact that it could be a big cost savings.
Well, we've got three. Let's see. I guess we have two alternatives here. Yes.
I guess I think the alternative is to wait and work on out a little better, so we know what's going to really happen. I like to know how many cases we have that we think are possible. Are we talking about primarily burglary cases? Though that kind of information we haven't really. We're going to make. We're at least in a position here now of making some major changes with, assuming there's going to be some cost savings. I like to know the, you know, the kinds of numbers of folks who might come into this, and I don't want to hear them now because we got a bill which I really care about coming up, and we've got a lot of other things on the table. So I guess I'm not willing to also go ahead with the bill unless we have a clear severance that everybody understands and the terms and conditions which you can sever now. And I don't think that's been, just looking at the Ninth Court of Appeals cases doesn't give me any comfort to know how we can use here. So that's my
Okay. Now, I don't know if there'd be any, of any consolation to the district attorneys. I expect to be the chairman of the Interim Committee on Judiciary, and for whatever it's worth, I would tell you that if this thing doesn't make it through the process, and I kind of doubt that it will, that it will be the subject, I would welcome it as a subject of the Interim Committee. And I do believe Senator Cohen's right. We've just got a mass of information that, and a lot of questions about this, and since it is a rather far-reaching step in Oregon criminal procedure, that's my own preference. But if you want to send this bill out, I would not support the House version by any means, but if you think we can do something with it, why, that's fine. That's about the best I can offer on it.
Mr. Chairman,
yes, Senator Hill.
I would have to agree with Senator Cohen. I like the basic idea about it, but I just, at this point, I know when my first session, 83, we spent a good bit of time on this issue. I mean, it seemed like weeks. And here we are now. I think it's something that should be looked at in the interim. If we had even another, we could spend more time on it, I'd be comfortable, but I'm just not comfortable with it now. And so
I share that.
Okay. Well, okay. Thank you, Dale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, okay, I think that's the way we ought to go on it. With it.
Mr. Chair,
yes, Senator
Hill. Did I hear Senator Hill say that your committee spent time on this issue, this interim?
Yes, there are some changes. They were mentioned by Mr. Penn, by Dale, two sessions ago. The issue was taken up, and it was a good bit of time spent on the issue, and it's not, it is a very complex.
I'm confident it is, but there was no bill filed or no action taken following the interim.
Yes.
83, we passed the bill, and yeah, 83 bill dealt with the other side of this, merging defendants.
That was it. Nothing that spoke to this particular issue as requested by the VA.
I recall some discussion of it. I think that it took us just to address the other part of the issue took quite a while. And as mentioned, there's a great deal of discussion on this issue. I just, as I say, I'm not saying it's not a bad idea. It's just that to make the decision right now, I just don't think it's enough time. I don't feel comfortable with it.
Okay, what's the pleasure of the committee on this bill?
Well, I'd make an attempt to amend it and move it if the chairman would.
Mr. Chairman, we have four people who've said that they want to have for an interim study, Mr. Chairman. I mean, we've got, there's a big bill coming up.
I didn't attempt that.
Well, I'd accept the motion to table the bill then.
I'll move
it. All right, Senator Cohen moves to table House Bill 2193. Call the roll, please.
No.
Aye.
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 Aye. All right, aye. Okay. Now we have House Bill 2324, and I've got a whole bunch of witnesses signed up for this. This is a bill that a lot of people have been working very hard on for most of the session, and it's a bill that I hope we can take care of. But I don't want to spend the rest of the afternoon on it either. I got a conference committee on Senate Bill 323. It's supposedly start at 2 o'clock. Senator Brenneman's on that committee. Senator Cohn's on that committee. And we're going to have to get to that. So I would say that...
Chair.
Yes, Senator
I
Hammond.
I suggest Dr. Gray coming first after witness. He can certainly help us step through the bill.
Which one first now?
Dr. Gray. And he would be able to step us through the bill as well as...
Yes, all right. Let's do that.
As
let's
well as certainly explain to us
yes,
precisely
I think,
what the House did and why.
All right.
Yes,
I think the representatives, we have three representatives from the governor's office here. So why don't you three come up? Kind of set the stage. Now we have, and then I want to hear, from, one or two of the opponents of this bill after we get through here. So go ahead. Who's first down here?
I think I'll go first. My name is Janice Yaden, Assistant to the Governor for Human Resources. Mr. Chairman, members of the panel, I can have a long version or a short version of how much the governor supports this bill. I'll give you the short version. This is a top priority with him in his human resources program. He felt strongly enough to put over $7 million behind this proposal. This is one that we've been pushing through every step of the way, and we're here to ask your support for this bill. I have with me Corey Streisinger, who is the governor's legal counsel, and Dr. Don Bray from the Mental Health Division, and they can answer the legal and medical technicalities of this bill.
Okay, now maybe the committee members know this, and forgive me if I'm assuming that you might not possibly. This bill, of course, had extensive hearings and work in the House, then it went to the Ways and Means Committee. It's been down there. It just got out yesterday, which is the reason that we're just now getting the bill. We've been waiting over here for a long time to get this bill because we did know it was a priority of the governor and the leadership.
Mr. Chair, may I add to that? There was an entire year's study prefacing the introduction of this bill, completed by not only a statewide task force, but a legislative oversight committee also. We've had many minds, many hours working on the bill.
I wanted the committee to know that that's, if it weren't for this bill here, I can assure you that it would have been, the president would not have let us hear anything in the last couple of weeks. It was the fact that we still had to kind of keep alive in order to receive this bill that we're still here even. And go ahead. Excuse the interruption. That's just background.
I would like to ask Dr. Bray.
Yes, Dr. Bray,
fill you in on the background of this bill.
The interim task force was appointed after two bills came to the last legislative session, one to broaden the commitment criteria and allow for earlier intervention in an episode of deterioration. Another bill to provide for outpatient commitment so that a person could be committed not to a hospital, but so that the procedures would be in the law so that if a person was committed to an outpatient program, they could come back in, they could be, and didn't continue the conditions of their outpatient commitment, they could be returned to a hospital if necessary. The problems that were identified by the interim task force were vast, and I won't take your time to go over all of them. In broad brush, they were the kinds of problems that the first I just mentioned, that a person has to deteriorate to the point of dangerousness to themselves or others, or inability to care before there can be an intervention. The commitment criteria And I'll only discuss the final product because I think it has been refined considerably in the House Judiciary Committee and in the process. In the final product, a person to be committed under the early intervention criteria would have to first be chronically mentally ill, 18 years of age or over, would have to have had 3 civil commitments to a state hospital in the past, or 2 in the past 3 years, and be in an episode of deterioration that would make there's high medical probability within the foreseeable future they would again meet the dangerousness to the self or others or inability to care. What this would allow then is that if a person meets this criteria, there would be an opportunity to place that person in a community program. Because the bill also contains provisions for outpatient commitment and for the conditions to be established by the court that, if violated, the person could be returned. These key elements of the bill would allow for that early intervention. Now, there are a whole series of provisions of the bill that deal with another broad problem, and that is that there was not enough information available at the time of the hearings. The various panels that we heard of judges and of attorneys and of families and of
this is ahead of time, sort of winnow through some of the information and present it in a little bit quicker fashion to a court. Because of this, I was concerned that $200,000 of money that would go for treatment of people is now going to go to district attorneys to conduct hearings under the being grossed version. Mentally ill persons aren't going to get any benefit of that money. The only benefit you'll see is probably in some judicial budgets. And because of that, I would suggest that is a bad resolution. If district attorneys are wanted, the money for those district attorneys should come out of judicial budgets because that's the area where costs will be saved, not in treatment or care of mentally ill people.
All right. Thank you very much. Any other questions? All right. Okay, thanks. Well, we couldn't give the DA's House Bill 2193, so we're going to give them this one. Let's hear a couple of quick comments now from Dan Varnes and Bob Lockwood, the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office, who are listed as opponents. I encourage brevity.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Don Varnes. I'm a member of the Metropolitan Public Defender's staff. Bob Lockwood can't be here today. In addition to being with the Metropolitan Public Defender's staff, I was a member of the State Task Force for Civil Commitment of the Mentally Ill, and a member of the Multnomah County Task Force dealing with potentially dangerous or chronically mentally ill. Very briefly, I believe that under the state of the law right now, today, this bill is clearly unconstitutional. The standard was first established by the United States Supreme Court in 1975 in O'Connor versus McDonald, which held that the minimum requirement for deprivation of freedom of a mentally ill person is either dangerousness to self or others, or inability to care for personal needs. In 15 years, the court has not retreated one bit from that position. The position of the Ninth Circuit is somewhat stronger in Suzuki versus UN, which was decided in 1980. That court said not just dangerous, but imminent dangerousness. So it appears that under the law right now, which is easily accessible to people, this bill would be unconstitutional. There has been a great deal of hope expressed that either or both courts will ultimately change their minds. In fact, an Attorney General's opinion provided to the State Mental Health Division suggests that under the parens patriae power of the state, they may well do this. 2 examples were cited in that letter. Both examples were of people who are committable under present Oregon law. So I would submit there's no reason to believe that that's any indication the court will change its mind. Perhaps the most important reason for not enacting this bill is that it probably won't do what it's supposed to do. Probably the most serious deficiency in the system we have for providing care to the mentally ill is in terms of outpatient care. On both the committees I was on, we heard testimony from providers of mental health care who, virtually all of whom, seemed to think that it's not just the hospital that cures people, it's the continuum of care that exists from beginning of treatment until complete until somebody is fully reintegrated into society. The problem that we have today is that our outpatient mental health care services don't provide that care. There is no continuum. There is, in effect, an abandonment of people when they leave the hospital. The mentally ill are divided into three different priorities or subgroups, priorities 1, 2, and 3. Priority 1, the most serious, are people who are in imminent danger of having to go to a hospital or dangerous to others. Less than one half of these people can be seen when they go voluntarily to a clinic. For example, in Multnomah County, one half to one third only are seen when they go seeking mental help because the facilities don't exist. Very brief with one last point, and that has to do with Section 16, beginning on page 12 and the following. Section 16 will provide that these hearings, in effect, take place outside of a courtroom. It will do that by permitting examiners to go to hospitals to see patients there, to reach their conclusions and opinions there, and then come into court and provide those opinions. That would be kind of analogous to letting detectives have free access to people and then come into a trial and provide their ultimate opinions as to guilt or innocence. Even though mental illness law is not the same as criminal law, there are substantial constitutional rights which apply to it, and I would think that that would probably be found unconstitutional in that people are deprived of the right to confront the source of the information which is used to commit them. Hospital staff, other patients, whatever people are the source of the information, which is given out of court to the examiner and results in a commitment. These hearings could turn into more than one day long hearings, very litigious and extremely expensive. Thank you. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Other questions of the witness?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bob Lockwood? Have we had Bob Lockwood? I haven't been. Nancy Terry. Yeah. Excellent.
Mm-hmm. My name is Nancy Terry, and I'm chairman of the Legislative Committee for the Oregon Alliance of Advocates for the Mentally Ill, and I served on both the interim task force and on the interim legislative task force. I'd like to introduce Arlene Wood and Nelda Grover, who are both family members and have served on my committee. We've presented written testimony to you, and we know you're at the end of a session and you're very tired. And so we mainly wanted to thank Senator Hamby for all the work that she has done to help with the passage of 2324. As you know, the families would much prefer the criteria that was in SB 361. That's right, numbers. But we are very pleased that the limited, and to us, it's very limited criteria, has passed in the House 59-1. And we hope that you will support 2324. I wanted to add that to the families and more research people, mental illness is a physical, biological disease, and the families resent the fact that we are put in a judicial adversary situation when it wouldn't happen if one of our children had diabetes or cancer or something, and it is this similar to that. Nelda and Arlene have worked on this very hard, and you have Arlene's, you were asking for some family stories, and you have Arlene's testimony, which is in one family, a horror story that covers everyone. So I think that if you would like to ask questions of any of us and to save time.
It's too bad. Hopefully the chair will be back because certainly this kind of testimony is all new to him. And perhaps Senator
Hamby, did you want us to read our names in for the record?
Yes, very much so.
But all right. I am Nelda Grover. I'm legislative chairman of the Alliance for the Mentally Ill. That's AMI of Multnomah County. I'm also currently serving on the board and legislative committee of the Oregon Alliance of the Mentally Ill, called OAMI, of which Nancy is chair. I wanted to say that we, although OAMI was founded in 81, I would just like to call attention to the fact that we were founded in 77 and have had a 10-year effort. Myself, I know, because I had the big story of 1979 about my son Ronald, and he beat us up between the first and second hearings, and if we'd gotten through the first hearing, we'd never have got beat up. So that the civil commitment process in 79 didn't work. We tried again in 79, 81, 83, 85, and this is our Multnomah County's fifth try. So we really want this, we really support this bill, and we really want it to go through. We think it's good. I would say that this excellent bill would not, that if this is a bill is a law, many of our mentally ill person, adults would not have to become violent or even commit a crime to get psychiatric help and needed hospitalization.
Mrs. Woods, would you like to read your...
Would you like for me to read this? Okay. I hesitated. It's quite lengthy. Well,
it says everything.
and do announce to, for the record, who you are.
Okay. I'm Arlene Wood, Portland, Washington County. My husband and I are the parents of a 26-year-old chronically mentally ill son, and I'm going to give you my reasons for supporting House Bill 2324. My reasons are because of our frustration and the feelings of helplessness my husband and I have experienced the past 7 years. In the fall of 1979, because of his strange behavior, paranoia, inability to cope with normal routine, and at his request, our son began private psychiatric care. After several months of psychiatric care, he was diagnosed as being paranoid schizophrenic. He refused medication, further counseling, and would not voluntarily commit himself. The doctor told us that commitment laws would probably be difficult to obtain and explained the laws and the commitment procedure to us. He also suggested that we start contacting our Washington or our county mental health department. We made the contact but found at that point they could do nothing because of the commitment laws. Our son continued living at home during 1980. During this time, he could not hold any job longer than 2 weeks because of his inappropriate actions. His condition worsened. His behavior consisted of loud talk, verbal abuse, lack of concentration, incoherent conversation, hypochondria, breaking dishes, throwing food, the belief that we were trying to poison him and stealing his soul, verbally threatening people, talking to his dad through TV, throwing a chair through his bedroom window and trying to back the car over one of his friends after an argument, and that could go on and on. He physically threatened me with a knife in February 1981. We called and then went out to Washington County Mental Health, filled out forms, and after the person in charge felt that we were sincerely afraid, the 3-day police hold was granted. The deputy sheriffs that picked him up were courteous and understanding and took him to Damage State Hospital. The commitment process had begun. The county investigator told us he didn't think there was anything wrong with him, but changed his mind when he ran away from Damage for 24 hours, again picked up at our house. He was placed in a private psychiatric hospital for 21 days, and after refusing treatment, the county scheduled a civil commitment hearing. The judge at that hearing concluded that he should not be committed because he was just a spoiled brat that should be out on his own. The next few months were very frustrating. Being fearful that he would carry out his threats, he could not stay at home. I made many calls to mental health agencies, city and local agencies, trying to find a place for him to live. There was nothing available for a male over 14 years old other than one-night emergency shelters. We tried apartment house living. He stayed with his friends for a short time and then in downtown hotels with our financial support. During this period of hotel living, he was evicted from many of them because he broke furniture, called the fire department when he thought they were gassing him, and was belligerent with the operators and tenants. He became unkempt and dirty. We again talked with mental health agencies trying to get help. They explained to us that under the present laws, they were unable to act. We were told that because he refused voluntary commitment, the only way to get help would be to abandon our support and make conditions so unlivable for him that he would commit a crime. In one 30-day period, he went to hospital emergency wards at least 40 times, believing that he was dying from poison or other reasons. His room and board money was used for taxi rides to the hospitals, and we received many night calls to come and get him. During one of these visits to the University of Oregon Medical Center, his behavior was such that he was sedated and held for an involuntary commitment hearing in Multnomah County, September 1981. At this two-hour hearing, the judge concluded that there wasn't any doubt in his mind that he was mentally ill and needed help, but under the present law, he could not commit our son. From this time on, his actions became more violent, delusional, and hallucinatory by physically threatening strangers on the street because they looked at him strangely, saying that we should both be dead and he was going to kill us, 20-mile taxi rides to open fields to meet the spaceships where they rejuvenated his cells, telling people to leave Portland because it was going to be bombed, and those examples could go on and on. Several of his friends and our friends called us during this time saying he was ill and needed medical attention and couldn't understand why we could not get help for him. In December of 1981, a waitress made a remark to him which triggered an outbreak that resulted in his damaging the restaurant, kicking out glass windows in a gallery, and damage to a record store owned by his friend. He was arrested and charged with 3 counts of felony for property damage. We were thankful that it was something that was damaged rather than a person being hurt. We did not bail him out. A call from city jail asked that we do that. He was placed in Rocky Butte Jail, and when we were visiting him once, an attendant said to us, "He doesn't belong here. He should be in a hospital." His defense attorney wanted to see him in a halfway house situation, but found that there were none available. The owners of the damaged property pressed charges, realizing this was the way to get help for someone who needed it. The trial was in February 1982, Multnomah County, and the judge ruled him guilty because of mental defect and sentenced him to Oregon State Hospital for 11 years under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. After attending three, and make that four now, we attended another one this summer, of these PSRB hearings, we feel this is a logical system to protect the individual and society. We are thankful that he is in the hospital where he has food, a warm bed, understanding treatment, and in a situation where he will not be abused or abuse others. I feel very sad for our son and for society having to suffer for his actions due to our inability to obtain help for him sooner. I feel that there should be a commitment procedure which would allow help before a crime is committed. And I feel very, very strong about that.
I have a question. Has he ever come out of the hospital under the supervision of the psychiatric review board?
He has not.
He has not? No. Okay.
I want to emphasize that this represents many, many, she's got it in one story, but many, many
Could
hundreds of families.
Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
She
has. I know, but.
Nancy Terry.
We need it if she's.
No, I can't.
Who Who else has not had a chance to?
While you were gone, I'm Nelda Grover, legislative chair for Army of Multnomah County, and I've already talked while you were gone.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any other questions? Thank you. Let's have Nellie Fox and Marjorie Crist.
Could I say something about somebody that was up here saying things against the hospital? My son has lived in the hospital at Damage for 5 years. It's a very good hospital. Also, this morning I got a call from a man that I met just 2 days ago, and he said his brother was in the state hospital, both in Salem and in Damage, and he said they couldn't be better. I think you don't get any compliments.
I think that I appreciate the compliments. I do. I have. Damage happens to be in my district, and I have a lot of people who work at Damage.
It's just that
who contact me, and they're under real trauma and real trouble, and it's not fair to them either to continue to add on to their problems. So I do think that we've got a lot of work to do in that area. Nellie.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Nellie Fox Edwards, and I'm president of the Mental Health Association of Metropolitan Portland. And my interest in the mental health arena has stemmed from the fact that I have a son who is schizophrenic, and I have gone through the trauma of everything that you've heard here. He was committed to Damish, released, and then has refused to take his medication. Senator Hamby, you asked the person testifying what they had to do. I had to file criminal charges against my son to get him back into the mental health system. I think that's a travesty of justice when you have to treat someone. Excuse me. You have my testimony, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And has your son come out under the Psychiatric Security Review Board supervision into the community? Come back out. He's
come back out of the system and was under supervision for a while until he refused to take his medication and refused to go into the treatment. That's when he started smashing things. And one of the problems, I think, is some of the judges' interpretations of what constitutes danger to themselves or others. My son was smashing windows at my house with a shingle hatchet, and I don't know if you know what a shingle hatchet is. I think that's a dangerous weapon, not only on one instance, but several different times. And it wasn't until I could threaten to file charges against him, criminal charges against him, that he did respect that and then go back into the system. He is working within the system now, and he's one of the more fortunate ones that medication does help.
Right. Yeah.
But it's a sin, as far as I'm concerned, that they get treated like criminals when they're ill people.
Marjorie, any other questions from Nellie? Marjorie?
Yes, I'm Marjorie Crist from Beaverton, Washington County. And I'm very much in favor of this bill. I have a son that who is diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic and has been for the last 8 years. He's been hospitalized 5 different times. First 2 times he was in a private hospital, and they kept him there quite a while. They overdosed him. He was like he had Parkinson's disease or a zombie. They didn't seem to really understand how to treat him. It hasn't been until he's been under the state, taken into the state hospitals, that he's been better. And the first time he was sick, he almost killed a member of our family with a loaded cock pistol. And, of course, we didn't know what was going on, but we found out what his problem was. And so thanks now, to make a long story short, that he threatened somebody with a chainsaw and was arrested, put in jail. He is now under the jurisdiction of the Benton County Mental Health Association there, and is being very closely watched by them, and is under court order in that county. Under that provision, we're very grateful to those people, the caretakers in Benton County, the doctors and the social worker, because they keep very close tabs on him. They see him twice daily to take his medications. They monitor his medications. It's a cyclical thing with him. He gets sick around the holiday time in the winter. In the summertime, he seems to be pretty well. In fact, right now, he has a part-time job. He's an excellent mechanic, and he's got a part. He works 4 hours a day, which is all that the association would allow him to work. And he's repairing lawnmowers. In this case, with these people, the patients themselves cannot speak for themselves for a bill like this. It has to be members of the family, and I'm not only speaking for myself, but for members of my family, and also for everyone as protection, not only the patient and his family, but possibly the general public, because these people can threaten anybody because of the voices they hear or whatever it is that's going on in their sick minds. So it's not only for our protection and his protection, but the general public. They are capable of violent actions.
Questions? Thank you. We have two people left, Eleanor Jones and John McCulley. Eleanor, go ahead. Why don't you go ahead, Eleanor? We'll let John.
I'm Eleanor Jones of Portland. I'm not the parent of a psychiatric patient. I am a psychiatric patient myself. Mine is not a horror story. However, without psychiatric care for a long period of time, and it's ongoing, I think it is very probable that there would be a sad, deteriorating end to my story. It's not the violent, it's not the kind you see on TV and hear about mostly. Once you see on TV are the horror stories and are the street people. The ones you don't see, we who aren't visible are the ones who are perhaps hiding at home. In hospital is essential for many psychiatric, emotionally disturbed patients, but it is not the answer, and a hospitalization itself is not appropriate for everyone. Now, I have been hospitalized several times, not committed, but hospitalized. But my form of preventive medicine has been once a week with a psychiatrist, a psychologist, and this year I have been fortunate to have a friend who is also an art therapist. There are many routes, many ways to go. I have had psychiatric care because I, and with the help of my insurance companies, have been able to pay for it, and I knew enough to seek help. But there are hundreds and hundreds of people like me who don't realize their condition and don't realize that there are options available. And for heaven's sakes, let's keep those options. That is predominantly with deinstitutionalization. That means community mental health centers. And the services that are offered are in jeopardy because of lack of funding. This civil commitment law, reform, I should say, is terribly important. The safeguards are there for the patient. It isn't that the pendulum has swung too far again. It has come for society and for the mentally ill individual both. I won't go through it because you know what the provisions are, but I very strongly advocate that HB 2324 be passed on and be sent to the governor, please.
Other questions? I would have one. Eleanor, if you if things in your circumstances came about so that either things were not progressing or keeping stabilized with your contacts and your psychiatric visits and et cetera, would you as a patient feel as if you one of your psychiatrists could bring this kind of action to get you into a hospital if you were going downhill, even though it were privately and not out on the streets, if you
right.
will?
Right. Maybe it hasn't been my initiative, but I have acknowledged that, yes, it is appropriate for me to go in.
Someone else made that determination and you had gone.
Yes, but it has never been involuntary for me. And I think that's because of my own particular circumstances that I realize. There are some times that I realize better than others, but no, I haven't been in the terrible circumstances that some have been. However, I was hiding at home for a long time before I was urged to get help and then did seek help.
Thank you, John.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is John McCulley, representing the Oregon Psychiatric Association. We, too, offer our support for House Bill 2324. Very briefly, a couple of comments. First of all, the question has been raised as to why involuntary treatment versus voluntary treatment and the fact that the governor has put $7 million into his mental health budget as a part of this bill. The studies that have been done indicate that those who are involuntarily committed have more severe mental illnesses and are more prone to commit criminal acts than those who are